Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Merkel Media.
Good, everybody. This is Joel Thomas, and this is Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? First, I want to say thanks to everybody who's been giving 5-star reviews across the board on all the platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other of your favorite podcast streaming apps. I just want to say thank you so much. You have helped the show grow so much in just a little over half of a year, and it's been an amazing ride so far, and I look for an even longer journey with all of you. If you're a follower of the show and you haven't given a 5-star review, please go give a 5-star review on whatever platform you're on right now. And if you're new here, wait till you listen to the show, and if you liked it, then go give a 5-star review. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. And for the people that have been asking, how can I donate to the show to help the show grow financially? There's a couple ways you can do it. You can go to YouTube. You can become a member there. There's several different tiers. Also, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits, and you can give a one-time donation, or you can set up a new monthly donation if you'd like to donate monthly. I appreciate everything you guys are doing for the show. Now let's get into it. What's up, Free Range Rabbits? This is Joel Thomas, and I'm back with another episode this week. I'm excited about this particular episode. This is a subject I knew that inevitably I would end up talking about, but I would say recently I've had several people either reaching out or commenting on this particular subject, and it is the question of, did the CIA start hip hop? Now, I'm going to preface this entire thing early on with, no, I do not believe in the slightest that the CIA started hip hop. That's just factually false. And I'm going to show today how that's factually false. As a matter of fact, I'm going to do a deep dive somewhat of the early history of hip hop leading up into what would be called the gangster rap movement of the late 80s, early 90s. That was what really started it. And obviously, gangster rap evolved
over the last 30 years into other formats. But this particular subject comes up a lot. And generally, I'm going to be honest with you, it comes from people that don't know a lick about hip hop at all. And that's fine because everybody has their own taste in music. And fortunately for me, I have a very eclectic taste in music. There really isn't a type of music I don't like. I would say there would be artists I don't like or songs I don't like. But generally speaking, I find a lot of creativity in all the different types. But not everybody's like that. And I know there are some people that are not on board with hip hop at all. I can't understand the words, and that's some old devil music or whatever, right? We've heard it all. And it'll generally be from people who will be listening to other types of music that's just as bad. So I find that a very fascinating subject. And also the fact that when somebody doesn't like something, whether it's good or bad, they're generally going to look for the bad in it. So one of the things that has been perpetrated through the conspiratorial community is that hip hop itself as a whole was started by the CIA. And that's just absolutely false. And I'm going to show that today in this episode. But what we are going to lead into is what the CIA infiltrated when it came to hip hop, specifically gangsta rap in the late 80s to early 90s. And we're going to show the possibility of why they would have done it and when they would have done it. Now, to say that the CIA specifically pinpointed hip hop as its only area to try to control people is just ridiculous as well. And I'm actually going to show you how they used jazz musicians during the Cold War as a form of propaganda. And also the Laurel Canyon incident and the fact that the CIA was manipulating groups like the Beatles, Jim Morrison, Rolling Stones, Frank Zappa. All of their fathers were connected to three letters or some sort of government format. And this has been done for a long time. You know, the hippie counterculture, there is a lot of evidence that the CIA controlled that narrative in pushing the youth to rebel against the government. And we're also going to talk today about the parental advisory sticker that was implemented because of Tipper Gore. We're going to talk a little bit about what was the actual purpose of bringing the parental advisory sticker out and putting it on albums. Was it really to help parents understand what albums that they should or shouldn't buy their children? Or was it a ploy to drive children to want those albums more? And we'll talk a little bit about that today too. And we will, towards the back end, talk about a mysterious email that got sent to a website called Hip Hop is Red. And this happened around the late 2000s, early 2010s, when this came to light and a lot of big music publications actually wrote articles about it, including the Rolling Stones. And we'll talk about, did that email actually have validity to it? And if it did, what were the implications of what was said to have happened in that email? Now, an interesting question would be, who was the father of a gangsta rap? And we will get into the history of where the word hip hop came from, and we'll talk about some of the early pioneers. But I wanted to bring this aspect of it first because there's an argument to be made. Was Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was the 34th president of the United States from 1953 to 1961, was he one of the fathers of gangster rap because of the laws and bills that he passed in place? And one of the byproducts of what he was trying to do in 1954, when the Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that separate public schools for black and white students were unconstitutional. They were bringing on the integration of black and white people into the same public school systems, which I completely agree with. And I think that's something that should have been done far longer than it took to happen. But I will say, because of it happening, one of the byproducts was what they called white flight. And it was a phenomenon that occurred in the United States after the Supreme Court ruled against segregation in public schools. And this was supported by Dwight D. Eisenhower. And because of that, white residents of cities in Virginia started moving to neighboring counties to get out of places where there were specifically black people. And this wasn't just in Virginia. This was all over. So people were moving out. And this is kind of how the suburbs were created. But what ended up happening was the other byproduct from it was these places that became specifically populated by only black people or mostly black people ended up becoming what we call the ghettos now, or what people call the ghetto now. And this is one of the reasons why I believe that gangster rap came out of this, because gangster rap was the more hardcore version of the original conscious rap that came before it. And we'll talk a little bit about that here in a minute for sure. But we're talking about fathers of gangsta rap. And another one, if we're going to talk about men who are not musicians, it would be Ronald Reagan. And he was the 40th president of the United States from 1981 to 1989. So pretty much all of the 80s, he was the president of the United States. Now, one of the big pushes of Ronald Reagan's tenure was the war on drugs. Now, I could do an entire episode on the war on drugs because there is so much to uncover when it comes to scandals, when it comes to covert government operations around the world, what they were actually trying to do with this war on drugs. But one of the things that came out of it, and this was in August 18th of 1996, the San Jose Mercury News first published this first installment of this three-part series of articles concerning crack cocaine, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Nicaraguan Contra Army. And I know people that follow conspiracies and conspiracy theories probably know about this pretty well, but for the people that don't, just a brief look at it. For the better part of a decade, a San Francisco Bay Area drug ring sold tons of cocaine to Crips and Bloods. These are street gangs of Los Angeles, and funneled millions into drug profits to a Latin American guerrilla army run by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. So what they were doing, the CIA literally brought crack into these low-income areas, specifically with high black populations, to start eradicating black people, not only to get them hooked on crack cocaine, to tear down their communities, but also to lock them up. And this was part of that war on drugs that Reagan was trying to bring along. And one of the big gangster figures during that time was Ricky Donald Ross, or Rick Ross, the original Rick Ross, not the rapper now who models himself after the real Rick Ross. But they were basically funneling Rick Ross and other drug dealers, but specifically Rick Ross, crack cocaine to distribute throughout their own communities. Now, again, this is a pretty dense subject, and I'm not going to get into it today, but I wanted to bring this up briefly because it's connected to Ronald Reagan and how that Dwight D. Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan were the precursors to help create the communities that the impoverished and disenfranchised would then create this form of gangster rap out of. which is the more violent version of the conscious hip hop that was already in the sphere from the late 70s to early 80s. Now, to get into the origins of hip hop itself, we got to look at the word hip hop, where it came from, what it ended up morphing into. So the origin of the phrase hip hop is unknown, the exact origin, but one of the oldest examples of the phrase appears in scene 2 of an anonymously written satirical play from 1671 called The Rehearsal. Now, it was thought to be written by George Villiers, the second Duke of Buckingham, and a few others. It was a satirical play aimed at John Dryden, and he was an English poet, literary critic, translator, and playwright. So they were basically making fun of him in this play. And there was a character in the play named Bays, and he says, "Hey, is it not I God Ha? For to go off hip hop upon this occasion is 1,000 times better than any conclusion in the world, I gad." So obviously a little old English there, but you can see the combination of the words hip and hop show up twice in this particular instance. Now, this play and two other later sources are mentioned as an entry, Hip Hop, in multi-volume dictionary from 1901 called A New English Dictionary on Historic Principles. And in volume 5, there's a definition. Hip hop is an adverb, a reduplication of hop with alternation of lighter and heavier vowels, with hopping movement with successive hops. So the combination of hip and hop has been around forever. We just talked about it showing up in 1671 and again in a dictionary in 1901. Now, a similar phrase called hippity hop goes back to at least the early 1800s and appears in a poem called Spring Weather, written by Elizabeth Cummings, published in 1882 children's magazine called Wide Awake. And the poem begins, "Hippity hop to the candy shop, four little men in a row." So clearly the early versions of what hip hop meant, it meant literally physically hopping is what they were pointing towards back in those days. Now, in the 1950s in Los Angeles, older folks used to call teen house parties them old hippity hops, which I could just imagine my grandparents, if they were still alive, probably saying stuff like that, which I find pretty funny. So this is the beginning of the evolution of where the word came from. Now, we're going to jump to some of the first rappers, and then we'll jump back into more of the origins of hip hop. We're going to talk specifically today about some of the artists in the late 70s, early to late 80s, and really get into that piece of where the CIA might have slid in to start puppeting or puppeteering some of the artists into their own ideas of where they wanted that specific part of culture to go. Now, if we're starting with who were some of the first rappers, we have to start with a song in 1946 called Noah by the gospel group Jubilaires, and it is often considered either the precursor to rap or the first rap song, which I've listened to it several times. It definitely has the cadence of rapping on a beat and rhyming. So to me, it is the first rap song, and I find it fascinating that the first rap song was actually written and performed by a gospel Christian group. So to all the people out there who are saying that rap music started from an evil place or the CIA or that devil music, actually, rap started from a gospel Christian group. And the song is called Noah. And the song's about Noah and the ark. And I'll read a few lines from it. "Hey, children, stop, be still, and listen to me. God walked down to the rowdy sea. He declared that evil had descended to man. Then he decided to destroy the land. He spoke to Noah, and Noah stopped. He said, 'Noah, I want you to build me an ark. I want you to build it 3 cubits long. I want you to build it big and strong. I want it 30 high and 50 wide, so it will withstand the wind and tide.' And it goes on, and it breaks down the actual flood and why Noah had to get on the ark. It's a very entertaining song, especially for the 1940s. And this group did several other songs. They did Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition, which was a response to the attack on Pearl Harbor. They did Before This Time Another Year / Ezekiel Saw the Wheel Rolling. God's Almighty gonna cut you down. Go down, Moses. My God called me this morning. Ring that golden bell. So again, this was a gospel group, and they were the first ones to really implement this rap cadence that has evolved over time. So I think that's our first example of just unequivocally that rap did not start from the CIA in the slightest, as a matter of fact. And this goes to also the idea that there are a lot of people out there, and there are people that don't listen to hip hop, that think that all of hip hop is gangster rap. And I do agree with you. What's pushed in the mainstream is a very negative product. But if you actually know what's going on in the hip hop world, there are a lot of Christian rappers. There are a lot of conscious rappers still to this day. They might not have Drake numbers, but they might have a few hundred thousand followers. They might have a very deep catalog of great music. I just think it also goes to your specific taste in music. So if someone didn't like rock music, obviously they're going to point toward the more negative parts of it, because that's our innate human nature to do that. That's what we do. But there have been countless conscious rappers over the years, which we'll talk about a few in that late 70s, early 80s part. But there's been a lot. I mean, even now, we've got several like J. Cole, Kendrick Lamar would be considered that. If you go back to the 90s, Nas, Lupe Fiasco, Chuck D, Common, Mos Def, Talib Kweli, the list goes on. We can go from any period of when hip hop started to where it is now. There are tons of conscious rappers talking about life and the meaning of life and social issues that are going on around them that directly affect them, or just what's going on around them in story mode. There are tons of artists. There's a lot of underground artists right now that are phenomenal. We talk about Christian rappers. Got guys like Derek Minor, KB, got Lecrae. Most people know him. Andy Mineo, another one. Jackie Hill Perry, Manchild, Bizzle. There's just countless. Again, there's so many, it's too many to even talk about. But I'm just bringing up this juxtaposition from the gangster rap narrative, because gangster rap is a subgenre of the bigger umbrella of hip hop. There are so many different subgenres that go underneath there. It's, again, too many to actually go into on the show. But I'm just trying to show up front that gangster rap is not hip hop as a whole. However, as I'm going to show you today, the CIA did infiltrate and made gangster rap one of its primary focuses to push onto the American public, even up until now. So really, when you see the type of songs that carry the most weight in the industry are going to be the ones that they want to push. And I'm going to show you a clip later of Ice Cube, who was originally from the group NWA, and after a few years broke out on his own and went solo, and has been solo ever since. Obviously, been in shows, movies over the past 20 years as well. But he actually talks about the CIA in the industry and the way that they funnel the black community into privatized prisons. And we'll talk about that towards the back end, because that's going to directly correlate to this mysterious email that was sent to Hip Hop is Red. But I'm just setting the tone early, because for people that don't listen to hip hop, have a huge misnomer on what's actually going on in the hip hop world or how it even started. And I have to set this tone before I get into the real aspect of what the CIA was trying to control within that industry. We've got Joe Hill Lewis, and he had a song in 1950 called Gotta Let You Go. And Joe Hill Lewis was an American singer, guitarist, harmonica player, and one-man band. He was one of a small number of one-man blues bands to have recorded commercially in the 1950s. So his song, Gotta Let You Go, and I would play clips of these songs on this show, but for copyright issues, I'm not even going to touch it. But I encourage you guys to go check out some of these old songs that I'm talking about. They're really good, one. And two, it'll give you an idea of where the rap cadence came from, how it started. And some of these guys were doing this in the 1940s, 1950s. So this was well before even the word hip hop coming into the music zeitgeist, and they were already experimenting with the rap cadence as far back as then. Now, really where the inception, in my opinion, of gangsta rap started was an artist called Clarence Henry Reed. He also went by Clarence Reed, but his satirical rap name was Blowfly. Now, he was born in 1939 and he died in 2016. And he was an American musician, songwriter, and producer. He was born in Cochran, Georgia, not far from where I used to live when I lived in Georgia. And then he moved to West Palm Beach, Florida in his adolescence. This was in the late 1940s. Now, during that time, Reed used to make explicit parodies of country music that was popular on the airwaves at the time. And it prompted his grandmother to brand him a blowfly. And this is a quote from Reed. In Hillbilly, you'll find some of the best lyrics and morals. I used to listen to Homer and Jethro, which Homer and Jethro were a country music duo in the 1940s through the 1960s. And he said they would rap most of the time, only they didn't call it rap then. They used to call it soul talking. So that's another version of rap that went on too with country singers. They would basically do spoken word over a instrumental, and a lot of times in a very rhythmic pattern. So it would have very similar cadence to what we now call rap. And Blowfly, or Reed, said, as a form of revenge, I would take songs like The Twist and I would change it. And I won't say all of the explicit things that Blowfly says right here, but he would basically change these nice lyrics to more explicit lyrics. And he did this as a joke. Now, what ended up happening was he became so good at becoming a satirical rapper, he ended up in the 1960s, 1970s, he started making these parody rap songs and his first XXX record, Oddballs, and then he ended up reworking it into a song called Rap Dirty years later. And this came on the album, The Weird World of Blowfly. And if you look at the cover, he kind of looks like a supervillain dressed up in a full superhero suit. And he was super sexually explicit. This was 70s, 80s. And he, to me, was the root of what we now know as gangster rap. He was the first one to really push the envelope, get really explicit, and very much the precursor to groups like 2 Live Crew. He was in that category, but he was pushing the limits of rap early on. And in my opinion, he was the beginning of what we now call gangster rap, but what it morphed into in the 80s. One of the other guys that's in the pantheon of guys that they call that started rap would be Coke LaRocque. And he was born in 1955, and he was from New York City. And he's credited as being the first MC in the history of hip hop. So he had a different style than what was cultivated throughout the mid to late 80s. He did what was more of what people call freestyling. So he would get on a microphone and just start rapping off of his head. He would rhyme words just using what he was able to piece together inside of his mind and put it out on the microphone. Or as it would be said in hip hop, coming off the dome. So he would do this in private at these events. They wouldn't see what he looked like early on. He would be doing this behind a curtain, and eventually he started coming out and rapping on stage with DJ Kool Herc. And Kool Herc and Coke LaRock were kind of a duo back in the early 70s all the way up until the early 80s. He also originated phrases such as "you rock and you don't stop" and "hotel, motel, you don't tell, we won't tell." And that was in Sugar Hill Gang's single "Rap the Light," which was considered the first mainstream hip hop song that just blew up. And we'll get into that a little bit here in a minute. But he's also one of the guys that's considered the pioneers of early rap. Some people think that he is the first rapper. Again, I don't consider him the first rapper, maybe the first person that was considered a rapper, the first MC. But as far as first rap songs go, I think we have to go back to 1946 and go to the Jubilaires for that. Another group in that 1970s, early 1980s, who is also in the conversation for being the first rapper or one of the first rappers was the Fatback Band, and they were an American funk and disco band. And they had a single in 1979 called King Tim the Third, Personality Jock. And again, go look these songs up. I'm sure they'll start playing for 10, 15 seconds. You'll say, "Oh man, I remember that song. It was so popular." Or they still play it at weddings now, or they still play it at wherever that music's played, right? So a lot of these songs are still played to this day. And the Fatback Band was a concept of Bill Curtis, and he was an experienced session drummer. And again, they were a funk band, but as the 70s started getting close to the 80s was when they started morphing into what is considered hip hop or rap now. And that's when they came out with their song, King Tim the Third. So as you get back to the origin of the word hip hop and how it is connected to the movement now or the genre now, we have to go to Keef Cowboy, who was a rapper with Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And he is sometimes credited with the term as it relates to hip hop that we know now. And it's said that he came up with the term while he was teasing a friend of his who had just joined the army. And he started mimicking the way they do left, 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 right, left. He started doing hip, hop, hip, hop. And it is a joke, but he ended up starting to working it, the word hip hop, into part of his stage performance. And it was later adopted by artists like the Sugar Hill Gang in 1979. And it's one of the earliest rap records, Rapper's Delight. And if you remember how that song starts out, I said a hip, hop, a hibbit, hibbity, dibbity, hip hop, and you don't stop. So I think most people know of that song, and it's played at weddings and all kind of other places that songs are played even to this day. And that was one of the first songs where hip hop was used in the format that we understand the genre is now. Now, there was another music artist, Afrika Bambaataa, and he was the founder and he was also a music artist under Universal Zulu Nation. And he was credited with first using the term as a five-element culture of which the music belonged. So he was the one to equate it to the actual music culture that we know of it now. Now, Afrika Bambaataa, whose real name is Lance Taylor, he was an American DJ, rapper, and record producer from South Bronx, New York City, and he's notable for releasing a series of genre-defining electro tracks in the 1980s that influenced the development of hip-hop culture, and one of his big songs was Planet Rock, and I can't play it, obviously, for copyright reasons, but if you remember the beat, da 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 da, everybody knows that beat when it comes on. I mean, if you're at some function and it comes on, everybody starts dancing. So Planet Rock was probably his biggest song to date, but he had several more. And it was part of that era before it started being defined as hip hop. It was called disco rap, and he was part of that, and they moved into when it morphed into hip hop. And obviously he was a part of helping to bring that to the forefront by using that word to define this genre of music. Now, the seedy side of Afrika Bambaataa is that he was kind of the first Diddy. So in April of 2016, and he was also a political activist, by the way, and he was one of the front runners during that early hip hop time period when it started being known as hip hop, as pushing this conscious rap, which I find very interesting. And it really plays into what I've said on this show a lot, that very good things are always infiltrated by evil, always. So that's why I always throw out when people say that Christianity is full of these evil people and it's such an evil religion. We can say that about literally anything. We can talk about conscious rap, conscious hip hop, which a lot of it was great. And even what Afrika Bambaataa was saying on the mic was good. But behind the scenes, in April 2016, this is when it all came to light, Ronald B. Stinger Savage accused Bambaataa of molesting him in 1980 when Savage was 15. Following those allegations, three more men accused Bambaataa of sexual abuse. And of course, Bambaataa issued a statement on Rolling Stone saying they didn't do it, but they just kept rolling in. Vice even published an investigative article titled "Afrika Bambaataa Allegedly Molested Young Men for Decades." There was a March 2021 interview, Melly Mel, who was a part of Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five group. And that was the same group that had Keith Cowboy, Kid Creole, obviously Grandmaster Flash. But he came out in 2021 and said everyone knew about the accusations, calling it hip hop's best kept secret, but would not respond when asked if he knew specifically. And it just became a whole entire deal where Bambaataa claimed that he didn't do it, but then there were these guys who kept coming forward. As a matter of fact, November of 2024, French hip-hop pioneer Solo came out and said that Bambaataa molested him when he was 17 years old back in the 1980s. So the idea that the music industry has always manipulated young children, or just the entertainment industry in general, since longer than we could probably track is absolutely true. But from all indications, Afrika Bambaataa was the first version of P. Diddy. And what P. Diddy did in the late 80s, all the way up until recently, before he was arrested. But to say that, again, because of what Afrika Bambaataa did, doesn't discount the good things that came out of the conscious movement. These were hip hop artists who were trying to, one, find a way to get out of the situation they were in, what they grew up in, also trying to build up the people around them. A lot of them did. A lot of them were deeply entrenched in the communities. And to that point, obviously, Afrika Bambaataa used that situation to feed his depravity, which you're going to see time and time again. You know, I brought up Christianity as a point to look at, but there are so many different aspects of good things and good organizations that have been created around the world that typically get infiltrated by evil. That's just how it is. It doesn't mean that the movement or the good intentions behind something is negated because of that. It just means that somebody evil got involved with something good, did some awful things to other people, and those sole individuals are responsible for it. Doesn't mean that people didn't get destroyed in their wake, but also doesn't mean the movement itself was evil. Just like Christianity is not evil because you have these evil people that twist and manipulate it. It goes always, and that's why I always try to look at things objectively anytime I look at a topic, because it's so easy to blanket statement things and just say, yeah, the CIA started that. No, they didn't. the CIA infiltrated an aspect of it. And this is what we're going to get into today. Now, we just brought up Melly Mel and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And one of their big songs was The Message in 1982. This is where we get the "Don't push me because I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head." The original version, not the Diddy and Mace version that came out in the 90s, late 90s. That was just them taking the lyrics from a very popular song. But the message was literally a message. It was talking about what was going on in the communities. It was talking about how they needed to get out of these situations. Again, positive rap, culturally important to the people of that time because of what they were going through. Not bad. Not bad at all, as a matter of fact. So you did have people who were trying to use their platforms to help. And really, in the early 1980s, even the late 1970s, hip-hop music was totally anti-drug and anti-violence. It was a social movement. And, of course, Afrika Bambaataa helped spearhead that. But there were so many other artists and DJs that were pushing that during that time. And they were trying to build up their communities. So what's the best way, if people start coming together, to build up a community? What do? You tear it down from the inside. So I do think that Afrika Bambaataa was tearing it up from the inside in his own evil way. And I don't know if he was prodded by organizations to do so, or that was just his own personal depravity. That's something we'll probably never know. But the fact that Diddy came along after him and was doing the same thing, it wouldn't surprise me if they had a license to be able to do things that they wanted to do to people for power and control because there were organizations behind them. Now, because hip hop was moving in such a positive direction during this period of time, gangster rap also started appearing in this mid 80s to late 80s. And I do believe that it was grassroots and it was natural. I don't think the CIA started it by any stretch. I think that people are talented. People have rough backgrounds. A lot of musicians do. And they're going to talk about what they see and what's around them. And if they are involved with illegal practices and they're allowed to talk about these things on record, they're going to do it. And this is kind of what happened in the 80s. Now, I do think the CIA picked up on that and picked up on how it could be used as a tool, especially as it was built in popularity. And we'll talk about that here in a minute. But I don't think that the CIA started it. I think, one, it's acting like people who work for the CIA are that talented, which I don't see it. I just think they utilized the talent that was around them. And these artists they used, just like they did with the Laurel Canyon incident, just like they did with a lot of those groups that we talked about earlier, like the Beatles. So they're going to take what they can and then twist it and manipulate it for their own means, which they've always done and they're still doing now. Now, you had this transition in the 1980s from old school to new school. So what ended up happening from about 1979 to 1981, 1982 was considered old school rap. You had Sugar Hill Gang, which you just talked about, Rapper's Delight. You had King Tim III, which you talked about, Fatback Band. All those type of songs were the early on songs. Funk You Up was another one by Sugar Hill Records. You had Curtis Blow, The Breaks. And as a matter of fact, Curtis Blow was one of the very first super mainstream hip hop artist to the point that he had his own Sprite commercial, which was unheard of during that time. So that was kind of the old school genre of hip hop. Now, when it started changing is when Run DMC, LL Cool J came along. And that was in that 1983 to 84 stretch. And that was considered new school at the time, which I think is hilarious because it's funny how it's really like an 18-year gap before we start calling music old school, any type of music. So that was really like a 4-year stretch. It went from old school to new school really fast. And this is when gangster rap started appearing. This is when you had artists like Schoolie D, who came out with PSK, What Does It Mean? That was in 1985. You had Ice-T's 6 in the Morning. And I'm sure most of you guys know who Ice-T is, definitely for his appearance on Law & Order SVU now, but he was a major influence on early gangster rap. And he even moved into a genre that was a mix of rock and rap. He was a big hardcore rock fan, and he came out with a song called Cop Killer back in the early 90s, and that actually got eyes on him by the FBI at the time. But he was part of that precursor of Schoolie D that started out this idea of gangster rap. However, I would argue that Blowfly was the first initial seed of gangster rap. I think that the way that he presented his lyrics very explicitly, he was really the first one to really create that. And I think these guys took it on board, and that's when the name gangster rap started appearing more and more. Now, you had other groups that spawned out of this, and another major influence in gangster rap was NWA. And they were an American hip hop group that was formed in Compton, California. And they were one of the earliest and most significant figures in gangster rap. And they're widely considered one of the greatest and most influential acts in hip hop. Now, the original group consisted of Arabian Prince, Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, DJ Yella, MC Ren. That was the first group. And their first album was in 1987 called NWA and the Posse. I think a lot of people think Straight Outta Compton was their first album. It actually wasn't. That didn't come out until 1989. But their first incarnation was those group of guys. Now, right after Straight Outta Compton dropped, Arabian Prince left the NWA. And then not long after that, in the early 90s, the entire group split. And they all started doing solo albums. As a matter of fact, they all did very well solo-wise. Eazy-E did well up until he died of AIDS. Ice Cube has done tremendously well in all kinds of different aspects of the entertainment industry. MC Ren was even a platinum-selling artist. And of course, Dr. Dre, who has been multi-platinum and has produced multi-platinum artists to this day. So the group itself really blew up, and they were the most hardcore rappers to really hit the scene. They pushed gangster rap to what it is now. You have to look at them as really being the premier pioneers. And I know we mentioned Ice-T and Schoolie D, and yeah, those guys were groundbreaking for what they did, but NWA went to a whole nother level. As a matter of fact, NWA was the first black gangster rap group to appeal to white America, and they sold out everywhere they went. And if you'll notice some of the old videos of a lot of the concerts that they did, it would be mostly white people there because white people were just feeding into the lifestyle. Not that they necessarily wanted to live the lifestyle. Some of them wanted to mimic it, obviously, but they enjoyed this very brash take on being anti-government, anti-authority. And that's what these guys represented. Now, I guess the big question is, and people have asked me before, and I've been back and forth with what I think about it, was the NWA created by a three-letter agency, or were they manufactured by a three-letter agency like the CIA? I want to say that definitely my mind's changed over the years on what I initially thought. I don't necessarily think that they were started by the CIA. And I could be wrong. They could have been. But what I really think happened was they were grassroots. They did start by the connection between themselves and meeting each other and creating this group. But I do think that once they got in a position to become promoted, I do think that there were organizations behind the scenes that wanted to push them to the forefront in the mainstream as much as possible. Again, white America was enamored with NWA. And to get to that level, there has to be something going on in the industry that's allowing this push. I mean, NWA was getting all kinds of heat from the government, threatening them. And in all honesty, that only helped their perception. You know, sometimes people think that the government's trying to stop them because they're bad. You know, sometimes it's the psyop. They're going to attack said group. It's going to make that group more attractive, and it's going to make more people want to buy their product, and it's going to keep this constant feeding of the beast of negativity. Because while I think that all those guys from NWA were writing about what was around them and writing what they saw, because there was a lot of negative things going on in Compton at the time, and even Compton now, but especially then. But I do think that the promotion of those things wasn't good. I don't think gangster rap as a whole has been anything really positive outside of the fact that some of those artists got out of some of the places they were in because of it. But as we'll see later on, that constantly talking about these things, constantly putting it into people's ears and the airwaves, it's just feeding this negative part of us, and it creates identities for people. Oh, I want to be that. Or, oh, I'm already here. I'm just going to level up to where they're at. So I'm going to start acting like them. I'm going to start selling dope like them. I'm going to start toting guns illegally around like them. I'm going to start doing all these things. And I can say from personal experience, when I got really entrenched into that aspect of hip hop, you start living the lifestyle. It's not that you're fake. You just start feeding into it. It's a lot like, I watched this documentary recently about Ric Flair, and he said something that was pretty profound, that the character Ric Flair became him even when he wasn't in the ring. And that's what ends up happening. People start seeing who they want to be, and they just start showing out this character. And we all do it. It's not just celebrities. We all can do it. And I think this is what NWA spawned specifically. But I do think that NWA in some format was manipulated. I don't necessarily think that they personally were connected to the CIA or FBI, but maybe the CIA, FBI was connected to promoters or label execs. And I think that's more likely. And when we get to this hidden email here in a minute, this mysterious email, we'll get a little more deep on that.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Less chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Now to jump to this whole parental advisory thing that happened, and this happened around 1985. So this is right around the time when gangster rap's getting started. So Tipper Gore, and if you don't remember who Tipper Gore is, she's the wife of Al Gore. And she bought the Prince album, Purple Rain, for her 11-year-old daughter. And obviously it was hailed as a masterpiece. And most people think Prince is one of the greatest artists of all time. And that's one of his greatest works of all time. So she starts playing the album, which again, some of it is, I get the parental advisory in concept, but also how do you not know what Prince is talking about or doing? You see the way he dresses, you see how provocative he is. He was really one of the first boundary pushers, along with Madonna and some of those artists, Michael Jackson. And you should kind of know, but obviously she didn't, or this is what she's saying. So she sits down with her daughter and they listen to Darling Nikki. And if you know anything about Darling Nikki, that is probably one of his most explicit songs. And she got so mad that she wanted to take this to the Senate and rock the music industry world, which she did. So she creates this list of songs called the Filthy 15. And these were songs like Prince's Darling Nikki, which we talked about, Sheena Easton, Sugar Walls, Judas Priest, Eat Me Alive, Vanity, Strap On, Robbie Baby, Motley Crue, Bastard, AC/DC, Let Me Put My Love Into You, Twisted Sister, We're Not Gonna Take It, which was actually a big point of contention because We're Not Gonna Take It was anti-government and it wasn't a provocative song, but the music video had violent undertones. And so she said it was a violent song trying to incite violence. So that got shot down pretty quick by some of the guys who came in there and testified against the parental advisory, which Frank Zappa was also one of those guys, which I find very interesting because of all of his connections to three-letter agencies. And was he playing the opposite side of the coin just for show? I don't know. I know Frank Zappa said some things in interviews that people love, especially the conspiratorial world, me included, but that doesn't mean that Frank Zappa wasn't involved. That just means he's maybe talking about what he's involved with. We got Madonna, Dress You Up. We've got Wasp, Animal, Def Leppard, High and Dry, Merciful Fate, Into the Coven, Black Sabbath, Trashed, Mary Jane Girls, In My House, Venom Possessed, and Cyndi Lauper, Shebop. Those were the Filthy 15, and that's what Tipper Gore was trying to push so they could create some sort of rating system for the music industry. Because, in her opinion, movies had it, so why didn't music have it? So it ended up that anything with drug abuse, suicide, Satanism, sex, profanity, all of that ended up creating the parental advisory system. So this is the same system that we see on album covers now. Not that people buy hard copies really anymore. You would see it more on the hard copies, but you will see them even if you log into Spotify or Apple. Certain album covers will have it on there still. So she was the catalyst for that. Now, the argument against it was it manufactured by three-letter agencies in the form of Tipper Gore to make those albums and music more attractive? Because what it did, it made kids coming up want to listen to it. Kids are just naturally rebellious. So when they see something with a parental advisory on it, they're going to get it. And listen, most of these stores were selling them to kids. I can tell you that right now, from me being too young to buy parental advisory album, you could just go up in the store and get it. You didn't need a parent. I'm not saying all stores. Some of them were strict, but there were a lot of mom and pop stores that are competing with the bigger conglomerates, and they were selling them. You know, I remember when Walmart wouldn't sell anything with a parental advisory sticker on it, and you had to get the clean version from Walmart. But a lot of the mom and pop stores did not care, and you could go and get whatever you wanted. So if it had the sticker on it, you wanted it more. And I believe personally that that was part of the push for the parental advisory sticker was to sell more records. I mean, we can look at who we were just talking about, NWA, as a major example of the more hardcore, the more people wanted to listen to it. Now, to start getting into the CIA's use of hip hop and just the use of the music industry in general, we're going to shift out of the mid 80s with Public Enemy. That's one of the groups I hadn't brought up yet for the specific reason. And Chuck D and Flavor Flav were the guys that started it. And they were considered conscious rap during that time. They were definitely talking about what was going on in the communities around them. They were definitely shooting shots against the government because the government wasn't helping. And listen, it's an absolute fact. You can go to some of these impoverished areas in Chicago and all these major cities, and you can just see the depravity And sadly, it's what the government's allowing. It's what the government's doing to people. We can say all day that it's personal responsibility, and it is. And there are people who get out of these situations because of their own will and their own ability to move forward. But I can tell you right now, the majority, it doesn't work. And when you create a negative environment for people to grow up in, from babies and have to see a negative environment around them, it's going to end wrongly in most cases. I don't care what color you are. We can just as much look at a large trailer park and say the same thing there as it is in some inner city place in Los Angeles. And I want to make that very clear. I know the racial environment, especially now, is very weird. I think that's the word I want to use for that, because while I do agree that this idea of white supremacy and white privilege and all these things are buzzwords that these three-letter agencies, in conjunction with mainstream media, including social media, is putting out there as some of the most ridiculous propaganda there is, it doesn't negate the fact that there is wrongdoing done to Black and brown people, that it has been for a long time. The problem is when we're on one side, we just immediately throw missiles at the other side. Again, what I try to do on the show is stay in the pocket, stay in the middle, try to understand what's going on around us, because that's what keeps us fighting each other. It's the, I'm white, I don't have any money, so why are you saying I got white privilege? But instead of understanding that that's propaganda, you start throwing missiles at the other side because of it. You start feeding into it. You know how many guys that I see that get on X or get on social media who have a microphone in front of them weekly, who feed into that, who absolutely come off as the most racist people on the planet in the idea that they're trolling, because they're saying, well, if they're going to call me that, I'm just going to act that way and I'm just going to troll it to the max. I don't believe that's a good way to combat it. Fire with fire is not the way to combat it. And again, even on the other side, you see it as well. You see this major schism that is growing larger by the minute because people aren't willing to look at the truth about what the other side's saying, but at the same time, understand that, okay, there are differences here, but the government as a whole don't care about any of us. And I think once we get to that point, which I don't know if we ever will, but I'm hoping at the ground level we can in our communities, that's when we're actually going to be able to progress and grow and understand that the system has been built for all of us to fail. And until we come to that realization, I don't know if any of us are going to be able to see past that. Now, to get back to Chuck D early on was going against the negativity that was being brought into his communities. But recently, he partnered with the government and the State Department to be a part of what Washington says the Global Music Ambassadors. And this is directly modeled on the government's Cold War era efforts to use the arts to inspire U.S.-backed regime change in Eastern Europe. And they also use musical tours as covers that the CIA could use to assassinate foreign leaders. This was happening back in the Cold War. And other artists that joined Chuck D in this recently, we got Herbie Hancock, Armani White, Breland, Grace Bowers, Jelly Roll, Justin Tranter, Kane Brown, among many others. And they were standing with the government and saying that, hey, we're going to kind of create this Cold War music 2.0. And this is what they're pushing right now. And I think a lot of people were super angry with Chuck D because Chuck D was so anti-government. And now that he's put his hat in with the government, now he's come out and said, oh, the government's not what it used to be back when I was coming up in the 80s. And this is why I'm doing it now. You know, the typical things people say when they're doing something that people disagree with. Now, I'm not saying he's right or wrong for it, but I can say that during this Cold War, that the United States flooded enemy nations with propaganda, but they also found that the subtle approach is probably the best approach. It's the most effective. And so what they did was they spent vast sums of money, taxpayer money, by the way, sending famous artists such as Nina Simone, Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald, all overseas, to the point where they made jazz synonymous with individualism and democracy. So people overseas started viewing jazz music as freedom, and that's what the CIA wanted. U.S. media networks like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty bombarded Eastern Europe with music which Soviet authorities banned. And so it became a subversive counterculture weapon. So Russia bans it. We're going to pump it into every country but Russia to show that this music represents freedom. They don't want you to listen to it. Clearly they don't, because this is music that represents freedom. And the music didn't necessarily represent freedom. It was just music, but they made it represent that. And this is part of how the CIA can integrate into something and utilize it and manipulated it for their own gains. And they deliberately chose to front the campaign with black musicians, helping to soften America's image and promote a, which I believe, a false message of racial harmony to counter well-founded Russian criticism of the United States as a structurally racist society. And you got to understand at the time that the Soviet Union was getting massive worldwide goodwill because they were responsible for defeating European fascism. So all these other countries were viewing communism as a way out of poverty, and they considered it far more supportive at the time of high culture and arts than capitalism. So CIA's way of combating that was to establish this Congress for Cultural Freedom, and then they sent all of these intellectuals and artists dedicated to opposing communism. And the best part was all these people that were getting wrapped up in it thought it was organic and grassroots, and it wasn't. The CIA started it. So this is what I'm talking about that the CIA does. They're not creating a genre. They're not creating music. They're just utilizing what's around them. They see something. It's starting to take off. We can use that. It's just like somebody that's coming up in any industry who becomes popular. Let's get him. Let's get her. Let's bring them in. Let's use them, utilize them. And listen, sometimes these artists don't even know what they're being used for. They're just signing off on stuff because it's money, power. Like, I don't, this goes back to what I've said on this show about celebrities and entertainment. I don't think all these celebrities in entertainment are worshiping the devil. I don't think they're all involved in the occult. I don't think they're all part of some EGI conspiracy. Which you guys know how I feel about EGI. I think it's, just go listen to my episode on EGI. I just was on X. I brought that up because I was on X recently, and I swear there's some people that are just dedicated to saying every single celebrity is that. And it's just not. Sorry. It's not. Yeah, you lost your skull cap if you think it's all. And it's back to, it's always this all or nothing mentality with conspiracy theorists. They think it's everything. It's not everything. Is there a small percentage that it could be? Absolutely. I'll give you that. But it's not everything. And this is the same thing with the CIA and then taking something that's already there and then manipulating it, or a piece of something that's already there and manipulate it. This is how they work. It's not in this overarching, everything's fake. It's just not. Now, as we shift to the last part of this episode, I want to play a clip from Ice Cube, and he's on Bill Maher's podcast. It's the one where they're sitting on the couches talking. And I'm going to play this clip from Ice Cube talking specifically about what he says he knows has gone on in the entertainment business. And I find it fascinating, too, because he's one of the founding members of NWA. And he speaks to what he believes, or what he knows, he says, has gone on in the entertainment business. And I find Ice Cube a very interesting person. He's definitely gotten blackballed in some ways by the industry, but then in some ways he hasn't been. He's definitely been forthcoming with things that we all seem to know. And then sometimes I think he's not. So I don't really know his place in all this. I try to take people at face value and say, you know what? He may be a good one in the bunch, right? We don't know. I don't know these people personally. I'm not the type of person that thinks everybody in the entertainment business is evil. I just don't think that. I think people change too. I think some people will get into something and figure out, oh, I don't want to get involved with this. And a lot of times those people get blackballed, or some people know how to play the game enough to where I'm not getting involved with this stuff, but I'll be on the peripheral, be over here. I'm not going to cross this line, but you know, I'll interact with these people that have crossed the line. And I just think that's business 101. I'm not saying if that's good or bad. I know me personally, I want to abstain from people that are involved in things I wouldn't be involved with. I wouldn't be involved with them. But again, everybody has their own moral compass. And when it comes to Ice Cube, I don't have the answer. I don't know the guy personally. He may be a great dude. He might not be. But I can say in this interview, he is talking some things that I've said for a long time. And we're going to play this clip, and then we're going to get to this hidden email.
Who benefits and profits off our bickering and our division? You know, it's like follow the money. I mean, I don't know their names, Bill, but if you follow the money, you go high enough, you start to see, okay, you know, this is an industry. Okay, let's take rap music.
Let's take it.
Same people who own the labels own the prisons. So
literally the same people?
Literally the same people who own the labels own private prisons. So, you know, it seems really kind of suspicious, if you want to say that word, that, you know, the records that come out are really geared to push people towards that prison industry.
But they didn't make you write those lyrics.
It's not about making somebody write the lyrics. It's about being there as guardrails to make sure certain songs make it through and certain songs don't. Certain flavors are exposed on the record. You know, some records are made by committee. Meaning record company guys sit around and tell the artists, this is hot, say that, do this. We're gonna have this guy write the lyrics. We're gonna have that. So the narrative is really kind of, you know, structured and really made into what the record company want the record to be. And what the, you know, a lot of artists are frustrated with this kind of music making. You know, a lot of people, you know, feel like they're being controlled by the label. This is how they do it. Telling you what songs to sing, what hooks to do, what songs, you know, you can do your song. That's fine. That's an album cut. But you want to, the single is what we all say is the single. So you have, you know, the record company pushing the narrative, you know, and you know, so this to me is in somewhat, you know, some social engineering going on here to make sure those prisons stay full. Now, there's a lot of dots to connect to make that happen. But I'm just giving you a broad example of how people at the top can manipulate what's going on with the people who are bickering and fighting.
So that's Ice Cube talking to Bill Maher about the CIA infiltrating gangster rap. And I thought it was interesting some of the wording that he used, because I do believe that some of it comes from this mysterious email that went to Hip Hop is Red. And the article that came out was called Secret Meeting That Changed Rap Music. So part of me thinks maybe Ice Cube knew about this, and maybe he internalized his time in NWA and realized, whoa, maybe what I did there, or even early in my career, helped feed this beast that they are creating. I'd love to ask him that question one day. I think that would be interesting to see what he thought about his early part of the career in that. But I'm going to read this entire email and I'll break here and there and tell you what I think about certain things. But I want to read it. I think it's important. And then I'll let you know if I think that there's validity to it, if I think it's fake, if it's real. And I believe that'll be a good basis for us trying to understand this manipulation of specifically the gangster rap subgenre of hip hop. Hello, after more than 20 years, I finally decided to tell the world what I witnessed in 1991, which I believe was one of the biggest turning points in popular music and ultimately American society. I've struggled for a long time weighing the pros and cons of making this story public, as I was reluctant to implicate the individuals who were present to that day. So I've simply decided to leave out names and all the details that may risk my personal well-being and that of those who were, like me, dragged into something they weren't ready for. So it's interesting. Apparently, this guy is a music executive and he doesn't want to tell who he is. He sends it to a guy who worked for Hip Hop Is Red, whose name was Ivan, which I was reading an article about that recently and how they didn't know of an Ivan that worked there. So the whole thing's mysterious. How this was even published to the point of who is this Ivan that even worked at Hip Hop Is Red, and obviously this mysterious guy as well. Between the late 80s and early 90s, I was what you call a decision maker with one of the more established companies in the music industry. I came from Europe in the early 80s and quickly established myself in the business. The industry was different back then. Since technology and media weren't accessible to people like they are today, the industry had more control over the public and had the means to influence them any way it wanted. This may explain why in the early 1991, I was invited to attend a closed-door meeting with a small group of music business insiders to discuss rap music's new direction. Little did I know that we would be asked to participate in one of the most unethical and destructive business practices I've ever seen. So, this guy's from Europe. He has been in the industry between the late 80s and early 90s. He's seen the rise of hip-hop, obviously, and apparently there was supposedly a meeting with all these top label execs to talk about the new direction of rap music. Now, I will say that gangster rap was already there. We know from the late 80s with NWA really getting hot, and this is the direction that a lot of hip hop was starting to move. So this is where I get this idea of the CIA is not starting it, but they're seeing the trend. And they're saying, oh, if we take this trend, blow it up, make it the umbrella of hip hop, make it what people think about when they think of hip hop. You could ask the average person right now, what do you think of hip hop? They're probably going to point 9 times out of 10 to something that's explicit or gangster rap. It's just going to happen. It's just the natural reaction that people have. They're not going to point to the myriad of conscious rappers that are out there or Christian rappers that are out there or artists who are not talking about those things. They're going to talk specifically to that. And this is where it was moving. So 1991, this is right in the heater. We got NWA coming off their big albums. You got all these solo projects coming out from Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Warren G, Nate Dogg. Not long after that, you got Wu-Tang Clan, all these artists in that early 90s block. 1991 seems like a pretty prime time to me. So that part of it I can completely see. The meeting was held at a private residence on the outskirts of Los Angeles. I remember about 25 to 30 people being there, most of them familiar faces. Speaking to those I knew, we joked about the theme of the meeting as many of us did not care for rap music and failed to see the purpose of being invited to a private gathering to discuss its future. Among the attendees was a small group of unfamiliar faces who stayed to themselves and made no attempt to socialize beyond their circle. Based on their behavior and formal appearances, they didn't seem to be in our industry. Our casual chatter was interrupted when we were asked to sign a confidentiality agreement preventing us from publicly discussing the information presented during the meeting. Needless to say, this intrigued and in some cases disturbed many of us. The agreement was only a page long, but very clear on the matter and consequences, which stated the violating the terms would result in job termination. We asked several people what this meeting was about and the reason for such secrecy, but couldn't find anyone who had answers for us. A few people refused to sign and walked out. No one stopped them. I was tempted to follow, but curiosity got the best of me. A man who was part of the unfamiliar group collected the agreements from us. So some people just backed out immediately. Now, I don't want anything to do with this. If I'm having to sign this because you're about to tell me something covert, I'm just going to go about my business and do my thing. Now, I don't know how it worked out for them. They might not have had jobs after that or whatever trickled down. But our anonymous guy who wrote this email signs it and he says, I want to know what's going on. Quickly after the meeting began, one of my industry colleagues, who shall remain nameless like everyone else, thanked us for attending. He then gave the floor to a man who only introduced himself by first name and gave no further details about his personal background. I think he was the owner of the residence, but it was never confirmed. He briefly praised all of us for the success we had achieved in our industry and congratulated us for being selected as part of this small group of decision makers. At this point, I began to feel slightly uncomfortable with the strangeness of this gathering. The subject quickly changed as the speaker went on to tell us that the respective companies we represented had invested in a very profitable industry, which could become even more rewarding with our active involvement. He explained that the companies we worked for had invested millions into the building of privately owned prisons and that our positions of influence in the music industry would actually impact the profitability of these investments. I remember many of us in the group immediately looking at each other in confusion. At the time, I didn't know what a private prison was, but I wasn't the only one. So this guy who only gives the music execs his first name, and clearly the anonymous writer of this believes that they're three letter. He tells them that all of the companies that own the record labels that they work for have invested millions and millions of dollars into these privatized prisons. And listen, I do not believe in privatized prisons at all. I think it's absolutely a joke. And I think this is what we're getting out of it, is some of this nefarious, secretive manipulation to keep them full. Because the more people in a private prison, the more money the person that owns the private prison gets. And you'll even see this with the medical industry that's privately owned in a lot of ways. And some people will say, well, that's capitalism. That's a good thing. And agreed, I believe in capitalism to the fullest, but I also don't believe in corporate capitalism. So corporate capitalism is what gets us in a lot of trouble. These are the guys that manipulate presidents. These are the guys that manipulate industries. These are the guys that tell us that we need to do something because they're telling us to do it for our own health. And that's something that I don't agree with. And this particular incident that this anonymous emailer is talking about is in the same vein as all that. Sure enough, someone asked what these prisons were and what any of this had to do with us. We were told that these prisons were built by privately owned companies who received funding from the government based on the number of inmates. The more inmates, the more money the government would pay these prisons. It was also made clear to us that since these prisons are privately owned, as they become publicly traded, we'd be able to buy shares. Most of us were taken aback by this. Again, a couple of people asked what this had to do with us. At this point, my industry colleague who had first opened the meeting took the floor again and answered our questions. He told us that since our employers had become silent investors in this prison business, it was now in their interest to make sure that these prisons remained filled. Our job would be to help make this happen by marketing music which promotes criminal behavior, rap being the music of choice. So they're laying it out. People that own the companies that own the labels own the private prisons. They want to keep them full because they're going to get more money from government the fuller they are. So what we need you to do is push rap music, specifically gangster rap, into the mainstream zeitgeist as much as possible, because what it will create is identities for people. It'll create behaviors for people that want those identities, who will then act on them and they will commit crimes, which will in turn fill the private prisons, which will in turn fill the pockets of the people who own the private prisons, which they're already offering these music execs stocks in the private prisons, so they will be motivated to keep pushing the kind of music that obviously the three-letter agencies want push. He assured us that this would be a great situation for us because rap music was becoming an increasingly profitable market for our companies. As an employee, we'd also be able to buy personal stocks in these prisons. So back to what I said from the beginning, rap music was becoming increasingly profitable. CIA didn't create it. The CIA saw that it was becoming profitable. How do we manipulate this? Oh, gangster rap. Well, gangster rap is becoming super hot right now. How can we take this and make it profitable on so many different levels? Immediately, silence came over the room. You could have heard a pin drop. I remember looking around to make sure I wasn't dreaming and saw half of the people would drop jaws. My daze was interrupted when someone shouted, "Is this an effing joke?" At this point, things became chaotic. Two of the men who were part of the unfamiliar group grabbed the man who shouted out and attempted to remove him from the house. A few of us, myself included, tried to intervene. One of them pulled out a gun and we all backed off. They separated us from the crowd and all four of us were escorted outside. My industry colleague, who had opened the meeting earlier, hurried out to meet us and reminded us that we had signed an agreement and would suffer the consequences of speaking about this publicly or even with those who attended the meeting. I asked him why he was involved with something this corrupt, and he replied that it was bigger than the music business and nothing we'd want to challenge without risking consequences. We all protested as he walked back into the house. I remember word for word the last thing he said. "It's out of my hands now. Remember, you signed an agreement." He then closed the door behind him. The men rushed us to our cars and actually watched until we drove off. A million things were going through my mind as I drove away, and I eventually decided to pull over and park on a side street in order to collect my thoughts. I played everything in my mind repeatedly, and it all seems very surreal to me. I was angry with myself for not having taken a more active role in questioning what had been presented to us. I'd like to believe the shock of it all is what suspended my better nature. After what seemed like an eternity, I was able to calm myself enough to make it home. I didn't talk or call anyone that night. Next day back at the office, I was visibly out of it, but I blamed it on being under the weather. So the anonymous writer tried to protest apparently outside to his colleague that he knew, but his colleague said, "Listen, it's out of my hands. They're already doing it anyway, with or without us. I'm just giving you the opportunity to make some money out of it because they're moving forward with this." So the anonymous writer is not feeling it. He's wonky. No one else in my department had been invited to the meeting. I felt a sense of guilt for not being able to share what I had witnessed. I thought about contacting the three others who were kicked out of the house, but I didn't remember their names and thought that tracking them down would probably bring unwanted attention. I considered speaking out publicly at the risk of losing my job, but I realized I'd probably be jeopardizing more than my job, and I wasn't willing to risk anything happening to my family. I thought about those men with guns and wondered who they were. I had been told that this was bigger than the music business, and all I could do was let my imagination run free. There were no answers and no one to talk to. So I get that. I get that at the time, he didn't feel like he could say or do anything. And I guess that part of it I can buy. Again, I don't know if I buy all of this, but I buy the premise, right? I tried to do a little bit of research on private prisons, but didn't uncover anything about the music business involvement. However, the information I did find confirmed how dangerous the prison business really was. Days turned into weeks, weeks into months. Eventually, it was as if the meeting had never taken place. It all seemed surreal. I'd become more reclusive and stopped going to any industry events unless professionally obligated to do so. On two occasions, I found myself attending the same function as my former colleague. Both times, our eyes met, but nothing more was exchanged. As a month passed, rap music had definitely changed direction. I was never a fan of it, but even I could tell the difference. Rap acts that talked about politics or harmless fun were quickly fading away as gangster rap started dominating the airwaves, exactly what I laid out in the first part of this entire episode, that hip-hop was not negative from the start. Never was. I mean, you had some guys that were obviously some outliers, but at the time as a whole, it was a positive movement. It was to help bring people together. What happened was you had the outliers that gained some traction, and then a three-letter agency, the CIA, sees that and says, "That's it. That's what we're going to use and push." And I'm not even saying that all the guys that came up in that genre of hip hop were doing it to control people. They were rapping about what they felt and A lot of it was not good, but they were rapping about what they felt, but they were being used. That's where that term useful idiot comes into play, because people can be used by what they're doing without knowing it. And I think that's a lot of what's happened. Now, I do think there are some artists that are connected directly to these operations. And one day I may go into some of that, but I think for the most part, a lot of these artists, even now, have no idea what they're doing. Only a few months had passed since the meeting, but I suspected the ideas presented that day had been successfully implemented. It was as if the order had been given to all major label executives. The music was climbing the charts, and most companies were more than happy to capitalize on it. Each one was churning out their very own gangster rap acts on an assembly line. Everyone bought into it, consumers included. Violence and drug use became a central theme in most rap music. I spoke to a few of my peers in the industry to get their opinions on the new trend, but was told repeatedly that it was all about supply and demand. Sadly, many of them even expressed that the music reinforced their prejudice of minorities. So you did have that too, where the music fed the negative aspects that people were saying about minorities. You had that too. That was the other part of it. That was the other manipulative part of it. And that's happening now. That's like when people say, I don't understand them words, them whatever. And that's exactly how people view that genre of music even now. And I don't. I think there's some just wildly creative and intelligent minds that have been a part of gangster rap. One, they're talking about their own experiences. Two, some of them sold out. And three, some of them are just feeding into what they think is going to make them money. And in a lot of cases, it has. And in a lot of cases, they were in such a bad financial predicament and in such a bad state in where they came from that they're willing to do whatever to get out of it. I officially quit the music business in 1993, but my heart had already left months before. I broke ties with the majority of my peers and removed myself from this thing I'd once loved. I took some time off, returned to Europe for a few years, settled out of state, and lived a quiet life, away from the world of entertainment. As years passed, I managed to keep my secret, fearful of sharing it with the wrong person, but also a little ashamed of not having the balls to blow the whistle. But as rap got worse, my guilt grew. Fortunately, in the late 90s, having the internet as a resource, which wasn't at my disposal in the early days, made it easier for me to investigate what is now labeled as the prison industrial complex. Now that I have a greater understanding of how private prisons operate, things make much more sense than they ever have. I see how the criminalization of rap music played a big part in promoting racial stereotypes and misguided so many impressionable young minds into adopting these glorified criminal behaviors, which often lead to incarceration. 20 years of guilt is a heavy load to carry, but the least I can do now is to share my story, hoping that fans of rap music realize how they've been used for the past two decades. Although I plan on remaining anonymous for obvious reasons, my goal now is to get this information out to many people as possible. Please help me spread the word. Hopefully others who attended the meeting back in 1991 will be inspired by this and tell their own stories. Most importantly, if only one life has been touched by my story, I pray it makes the weight of my guilt a little more tolerable. Thank you. And then obviously no name because it's anonymous. So do I think it's real? I don't know. And I think we all got wrapped up in it initially when it came out. And I do think that the premise of it makes a lot of sense. And we just heard Ice Cube talk about it too. And he seems to allude that he knows more of what's going on than he's allowed to talk about. He won't say any names. And it makes me wonder, too, back in his time with NWA, what he knew and didn't know. And maybe when he left NWA, what he was able to look back in retrospect and say, oh, well, that was going on, or these people were trying to manipulate. I'm sure he's seen a lot. I'm sure a lot of people in the entertainment industry have seen a lot of things very similar to this. So it could be a couple of things. Either this guy's really a music exec, and this is what he did. He sent it to some low-tier hip-hop outlet, because it was. It wasn't your typical, hey, let me send this to Rolling Stone. Even though Rolling Stone did an article on it, he didn't send it to any of the big dogs. You know, shockingly, didn't send it to any of the big magazines, hip-hop magazines, like The Source. which I don't even know if the source would have even taken that on board, as they were a primary outlet to push that type of music. But it could have also been just somebody who was an artist or somebody connected to somebody in the industry that knew about it. And they wrote it in a way that they were a music executive so that, one, it would take the heat completely off of them. Because if you're looking for somebody, you're going to be looking for a music exec, one of the few that were at this supposed meeting. So it could have very well been a fabricated story built on the truth. So I look at it in that aspect too, that the meeting might not have actually happened. It could be that the idea of the CIA and privatized prisons and the brokering of this push for gangster rap to fill the privatized prisons happened, but it could have happened in individual meetings, or it could have just been something that trickled down from the top that was told to label execs to do. And once someone figured out what was going on, they wrote it in this way just so the information would get out there to people. Again, I don't know. We don't know much. We don't even know the guy that wrote the article originally, the guy that was sent to you, Ivan. So that's my thoughts on the actual email. Now, do I think that this is part of the reason that gangster rap's been pushed so hard? Yes, I do. And I do agree with Ice Cube. I do agree with other people that are saying this is going on. As far as the email itself, that's up in the air, but it was a catalyst to get this information out there, to get people talking about it. And I think people become more aware of how gangster rap has been such a detriment to society as a whole. And I'm not talking about hip hop. Again, I have made the division early on in this episode between hip hop and gangster rap. Again, gangster rap is a subgenre of it. It's just a part of it. Now, has it become the premier part of it in this era? Absolutely. It has, to the point that people think that that's hip hop. And it's not. It's just not. And even now, there are tons of artists out there who are doing hip hop in the way that it was intended. And, you know, I appreciate that. You know, I love all kinds of music and I do love hip hop. I came up in hip hop and I've seen all of it, the good, bad, and the ugly. And I do think that there is definitely a very positive aspect of it that is still alive and well today, especially with the rise of the independent artist over the past 10, 15 years, where you don't need a label. People are doing their own music or putting it out themselves, and you're seeing artists get major platforms off of it who are preaching a good message. And for that, I can appreciate. And guys, I really appreciate you sticking with me today. I thought this would be an interesting episode to talk about hip hop in a way that some people might not expect, especially people that don't like hip hop. But again, I just try to get to the truth, try to stay in the middle as much as possible and show what's actually going on in the world or what's actually happened in the past. And again, guys, I really appreciate you guys lighting up the 5 stars on all the platforms. If you can, if you haven't done it, please go do it now. It helps the show grow. It helps it get out into the algorithm. Please share the show. That's another way to get the show to grow. Pass it to everyone you can. And on the way out, we're going to play my new song, Spinning, which is a hip-hop song, by the way, a positive hip-hop song. Hope you guys enjoy it. And you know what it is, guys. Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole.
Sometimes I feel alone when I'm looking at myself, cause I look down a road full of bottles, broken nails. So I just try to go, swerving off the road. I used to do it for the roses, adulation so they notice. Used to say they weren't my focus, lying, jonesing for the Joneses things. I know that everything that's going on can start to overwhelm, like the war on terror is just a war within ourselves. Are you woke or are you awake? Genuine or are you fake? I'm feeling like I'm sent by UPS with all the tape. These boxes are made by delusions that we chase, but I'm just staying base. Snakes are slithering, they keep it snake. She coming with the cake, but how is bait? Is important, but so is what you bring. Cause being real ain't acting like a king. I feel I'm spinning round and about to crash. Chaos all around me, feeling trapped. All this pressure mounts, I wanna crack. Like I'm going around in circles. Like I'm going around in circles. look at leashes on the collars of these people. Follow monsters like a Mogwai in the water, then they multiply. It's easy to get bitter. I'd rather dulcify. I'd rather justify anything but selling me. Leave me alone with the mic like a spelling bee. Smoking guns in your face, but you disagree. I ain't have to change your mind. I'm just hoping that you'll listen. I'm just hoping that a little bit of what I'm saying will make you take a second and see that everything ain't adding up. I know it's hard. I know it's hard. I feel I'm spinning round and about to crash. Chaos all around me, feeling trapped. All this pressure mounts, I wanna crack. Like I'm going around in circles. Like I'm going around in circles. Like I'm going around. Like I'm going around. Like I'm going around in circles.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.